Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Big thanks to our sponsor, 16 Degrees Coaching. Do you feel stuck in your current job? Do you wish you had a career you loved? James, from 16 Degrees Coaching, specialises in working with people like you. He'll help you find clarity in what you want to do next, even when you have no idea yourself, and confidence to move forwards. To see the success James has had in helping others with their careers, and to find out what he can do for you, visit his website, 16degreescoaching.co.uk, to book a free consultation, or follow the link on ours. Welcome to Season 2 of The Backstory. I'm Claire Mutimer, and with my podcasting partner Susie Coulson, we're very excited to be back with a whole new set of stories. Great, compelling personal accounts from people who have been through a whole variety of life's big challenges. This is the kind of grit that's going on in everyone's everyday that we need to talk about more. But this week, we've broken away from our norm to bring you a slightly different backstory, that of Norman Lamb, former care minister in the coalition government and one of the few Lib Dem MPs who survived the great cull of the last election. We approached him because we felt he was a great match for the backstory. A huge mental health campaigner, he has personally and politically had first-hand experience of what it's like to navigate the mental health system. He is well known both nationally and in particular where Susie and I live, in North Norfolk, where he's been the MP since 2001. Susie met with Norman to find out more.
We're all ultimately vulnerable. We're fragile human beings, and adversity can strike any of us at any moment.
I went to interview Norman Lamb in his inauspicious constituency office near to the local garden centre. He talks a lot about mental health. He's also spoken about how his own family has been affected by mental health issues, specifically his son Archie's struggle with OCD and the death of his sister Catherine, who killed herself in 2015. I started off by asking about Archie.
There are still issues, of course. You know, we all have mental health. We're all on a sort of continuum. But I think he's become much better, more mature at managing the challenges that he faces, and has done so incredibly impressively. I've got enormous admiration for how he's turned himself around, really, after a very difficult period.
We made a programme on women with OCD, and what surprised me was the different ways in which it can manifest itself. And I think she felt a degree of frustration at the stereotype of people turning on and off light switches. Can I ask how your son's OCD manifested itself?
So you hear people talk about them being, I'm feeling a bit OCD today. And that is, and it's an entirely innocent thing that people say. They don't mean to be offensive in any way. But it completely misses the point about OCD. OCD in its true form involves obsessive dark thoughts. So you get something fixated in your mind. that you can't remove. And it's often things that people feel very ashamed about. So, and I have no idea really what the dark thoughts are that Archie's coped with. I haven't ever been there with him. But it could, for example, involve you feeling, you know, I could kill my mother. I'm holding this knife. I could kill someone. What's stopping me from doing this? And it's a sort of an irrational thought. And, you know, when I went, I visited the Maudsley Hospital in London to the head of the anxiety unit there. He described this to me, and he said that often it's the people who are least likely to do something awful who, and it's sort of like an overblown conscience, but you can't escape from it. And then you start to develop rituals, the washing, the checking, in order to, you know, if I do X, Y, and Z, then this awful thing won't happen. And then you become completely trapped by the rituals. So there was a time when he found it hard to walk down a road because he keeps seeing sharp objects on the ground and he would have to pick them all up to check them. And so this, you know, you can imagine for a teenager, this is extraordinarily disabling. And I remember the moment when he said to me, Dad, why am I the only person who's going mad? And it's, you know, for a parent to hear that, that's quite hard. And you realise that, you know, teenagers can be brutal at the best of times. But if you're trying to cope with something like that, on top of everything else, that really is quite tough. And, you know, it starts to explain some of the pretty awful behaviour, you know.
As a parent, I imagine it's incredibly difficult seeing your child go through anything like that. Did you have any sense of how best to respond?
Well, that's an interesting point, because one of the things that I stress when I speak about young people's mental health is that often parents are left completely sort of stranded. We had no guidance really at all from anyone about how we should be supporting him. And it's quite interesting with OCD because, you know, often the individual will say, you know, Dad, have I checked? Is the oven off as you're going out of the house? And do you indulge that by going and checking that the oven's off? Or do you say, no, of course it's off? And going down either route will have consequences. But you don't know which route you should be going down, whether to indulge the obsession or whether to sort of crush it. And so I think, you know, in dealing with young people's mental health, as much as possible, you should be trying to work with the whole family unit, because the knock-on effect on the whole family is profound. And that includes, and it's really important to stress this, the siblings as well. So Archie has a younger brother, Ned. And so the great danger, of course, is that as you're trying to cope with this quite complex individual, very easy not to give time to the sibling. So you always have to make sure that you're trying to compensate for that and to, you know, treat them both equally.
How's he doing now?
So he's in a miles better place now and doing very well in the music business. He's just established his own mini record label under the Virgin umbrella. He has artists that he manages and he's incredibly busy, works long hours and is very driven in what he does. And we've remained close.
Archie launched the career of Tinchy Strider and has been out to meet with Jay-Z. Go on, even I've heard of those guys. It's pretty impressive stuff. I hadn't planned to ask about the death of Norman's sister, but he'd mentioned her as I was setting up the microphone, so I checked whether he'd be okay to talk about the impact of her death.
I became interested in mental health as an opposition spokesperson back in the last decade, and became aware that people with mental ill health suffered a disadvantage within the NHS. They didn't have the same right to access treatment on a timely basis and so on. Then we had our own experience with our son, and we were let down by the NHS ourselves. We were told we'd have to wait 6 months for treatment. And we couldn't wait that long. So what did we do? Well, we paid for treatment. But how can you justify a situation where people who have money can get access to help and others can't? But that's the reality in this country. Then after our mother died, my older sister Catherine experienced a period of severe clinical depression, I think, which was probably triggered by our mother's death. And she ended up as an inpatient for about 10 weeks and was subsequently discharged, and some months later took her own life. And so our family has gone through the trauma that very many families around our country experience with the loss of a loved one through suicide. Interestingly, before any of this happened, as a minister, together with Nick Clegg, that much maligned individual who was always totally supportive of what I was doing on mental health and always sought to get money available for what I was doing, he and I together launched what we called Zero Suicide Ambition. This comes from Detroit originally, where they had a very high suicide rate, and they sought to confront that and to be much more audacious and ambitious in reducing the suicide rate. So they sort of took the view, no number of suicides is an acceptable number, and that we should aim to save every life. So we launched that same sort of national ambition in this country, and we challenged mental health trusts to adopt that approach because we know the evidence is there about how we can save lives, but we're not giving it enough priority. So be audacious and then apply evidence. And then I lost my own sister. And so the experience of all of this and also learning about, you know, the how she was cared for, and there was no expense spared in the care that she received in her part of the country. But I just asked the question, was it the best way of, she was kept as an inpatient, but actually I think reconnecting her with her social contacts, her neighbours, her friends, the things that she was motivated by, perhaps that might have been a more effective way at giving her a life back. I don't begin to diminish the complexity of this, but I'm interested in how we become more effective at saving lives, and so I'm very much driven by the ambition to reduce the suicide rate in our country. I'm involved with a group who are sort of pursuing this zero suicide ambition. They've got more than half of the mental health trusts across the country signed up. I think there's nothing that is more important ultimately than saving lives. The knock-on effect of a suicide is profound amongst both family and friends and work colleagues. So it's a really important objective. But again, you know, I think it's my interest in this issue has been informed by our own family's loss, but not formed by it.
Straight into policy. I wonder if that's the case with all politicians. When faced with a problem on a societal scale, I think my tendency is to feel slightly dispirited, shrug my shoulders, and assume that the problem is just too big to tackle. But Norman's response is different, and as a politician, it's right that it should be. His response is to ask, what do we know about this problem, and what can we do with that knowledge? I wondered whether he looks after himself.
Well, probably not well enough. This job is all consuming, and
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need.
Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Do commit body and soul to it. If you want to do it in the way I've chosen to do it. And I don't, you know, there are different models for doing this job. There's no job description. No one tells you what to do. You know, it is completely all consuming. And I don't get enough of a break. I don't get enough sleep. I do try to keep myself moderately fit. I run once a week. I get on my bike when I'm back in Norfolk. I go and watch Norwich City, which is often more stressful than relaxing. And we have a close family.
Do you get time alone where you're not working, where you're not? I mean, you said that you're out on the bike when you're cycling or when you're running. Are you thinking about politics? Are you thinking about work or are you thinking about other stuff?
Well, quite often you are thinking about politics, the job, pressures, stresses. There's often, you know, there's something looming on the horizon, a speech that you have to make or whatever that you can't necessarily escape from. And I'm not someone who just has total self-confidence at all.
I can relate to this, and I imagine you can too, unless you're Boris Johnson.
When I went into government, particularly, but not exclusively, this is the case with the Conservatives, but in the Conservatives, there are very, very many people who've been to top public schools and top universities and who are totally self-confident. And to start with, I thought to myself, what the hell am I doing here? And not having the confidence to speak out and to sort of develop my role and my influence. And then bit by bit, you start to realise that actually some of the people who have enormous self-confidence are actually fools and are rather stupid. It's not the case with all of them. There are many who are good people who are trying to do the right thing, but it's not a given that people with great self-confidence have great ability or great judgment. That's the key thing, having good judgment, wise judgment. And so bit by bit, you start to think, oh, hang on a minute, I've got something to say here. And actually, they're being very stupid on this. And so bit by bit, as a minister, you sort of learn how you can achieve things, how you can use power to get things done. So you become, I think, more effective as you do your job. But, you know, going into Parliament and then becoming a minister, these are big hurdles, psychological hurdles I had to overcome. Speaking in Parliament, big hurdle. And I still get nervous, you know, in public events, going on to BBC Question Time, which I've done, you know, 5 or 6 times now. But it's scary to do it. But I think bit by bit, the psychological hurdles are overcome and you move on to the next stage. But it's not easy.
I wish that we could figure out how to replicate that confidence across the state sector so that all children grew up with it.
Totally. And that, you know, the absence of social mobility in our country is a massive issue, I think. And, you know, it's both wrong because there are people with enormous talent who don't get the opportunity to use that talent. But also it's very stupid because the country is not exploiting its human capital effectively. The pool of people who become top judges, top politicians, top business people, top people in the media is a very small pool because they're being selected far too much from private schools.
You speak quite plainly. Do you think I know you were 60 recently, weren't you? Have you changed? Do you think you're different now from how you were in your 40s? Do you think you're a bit more inclined to kind of speak a bit more bluntly?
I think you do get to the point where you just decide, I'm just going to say what I think, and to hell with the consequences, as it were. And so I think you become more confident at just being straight, totally straight. I've always tried to be straight, and I've tried to avoid through my political career getting involved in the sort of slanging match, because I think that just turns people off. But I think it becomes a little easier to be open as you, you know, I've been a minister now. I'm one of a small number of people, certainly liberals in the post-war period, who've had that opportunity. I've been very lucky with that. I don't want to always just be cautious. What's the point? You know, you achieve nothing. So speak out and be straight with people about issues that you care about.
Norman's personal experiences have clearly brought a depth of understanding to his political career. But it's clear that his interest in politics was there from an early age.
There's a photograph of me with a liberal rosette, I'm afraid, at the age of about 5. So it goes back a long way.
Is that your William Hague moment?
I try to avoid that association.
And you went off to study law. Was that something that you knew you wanted to go into? I don't know whether people drift into the law. What prompted that?
So I went to university initially to do social sciences. I was not a great achiever at all. I got in through clearing. I had two bright older sisters, both of whom had been head girl of their schools. And then I came along, and I think my parents, they weren't necessarily in despair about me, but I don't think they had any enormous expectations for me.
Norman was more interested in football and art, but as he puts it, he conformed and went to Leicester University, transferring to a law degree after his first year. Upon graduation, he was elected as chair of the university's law society, and through that, ended up working as a parliamentary assistant for a Labour MP. My feeling is that there are two sorts of politicians, and I don't know whether this is unfair, but my feeling is that there are some who want to achieve that position as a way of bringing about change, whatever they believe positive change to be. And there are others that I think are drawn to it for the position of power that it holds. And I'm sure that you must have come across the latter in your professional career. How do you deal with people who are maybe in politics for different reasons from yourself?
Yeah, I always say that I think politics and parliament reflects society. You know, it's a whole mix of people, 650 people. And there are some people who are very much motivated by trying to do the right thing as they see it. They have there's a wide variation of perspectives on how to achieve a better society. And there are others who are very much in it for status, for position, and perhaps the wrong reasons. But, you know, in a way, that's just the same anywhere in society. Some people go into politics with the right motivations, but it's quite difficult sometimes to stay true to what you believe in. Sometimes people lose sight of what they went in for, and it becomes a game. And that's what you've got to try and avoid. There are moments when you are encouraged to compromise, and sometimes it's right to compromise.
Norman certainly had experience of compromise, having served in the coalition government.
And in a way, the experience in the coalition is a sort of classic case study, really, because there were various occasions when I could have resigned from my position in the government and made a stand. And then, of course, you're on the outside and you have no longer any influence. Now, I stayed through that the coalition, and I continue to believe that we did some very valuable things, whilst at the same time there are things that the coalition government did which I disagreed with.
And, of course, when you're a minister, you're still a constituency MP, attending local meetings and being told in no uncertain terms what your constituents think.
That's what you have to do, though. And if you take responsibility, you have to be able to justify yourself and to be accountable. So, you know, absolutely right to put yourself in front of that sort of gathering. But the whole experience was at times quite brutal, and, you know, aggressive abuse is not something particularly enjoyable. And, you know, there are many ways of having a more enjoyable life at times like that.
Not a job for the faint-hearted. And to return to where we started, there's family life to consider. Norman's wife, Mary, has been hugely supportive throughout his political career.
Politics breaks a lot of marriages. That's the brutal truth of it. And you're away from home a lot. You know, every week you're in London for 4 days. And that creates enormous strains. And when our two boys, I mean, I was elected when our two sons were, you know, 12, 9, that sort of age. And so we went through the teenage years with me being absent for much of the week, which meant that Mary was in effect a single parent for chunks of time during some really difficult years. And so she was on the front line, as it were. The bottom line is that we've had a very close partnership, which has seen us through difficult times, which you couldn't have got through, I don't think, on your own. And also, you know, if there was ever any risk of me getting above myself because of this job, and sometimes you get blandishments and people being, you know, nice about you and so forth, I was always brought right down to earth by Mary.
Thank you to Norman Lamb and to everyone in the office who kept the noise down during the recording. What struck us both was the overlap between the personal and political. We'll be talking about this more on Backchat, which goes out this Friday, the 16th of March. We'll also be returning to the subject of suicide soon. Never an easy listen, we know, but we think there are stories worth telling. If you're interested in the OCD element of this story, you may like to listen to episode 3 of season 1, An Unwelcome Presence. Next week, we'll hear from Martin and Mo, who in their 50s unexpectedly welcomed a new member into the family that took their lives in a completely different direction. If you've listened before, then thanks for sticking with us during our break. If you're new to the backstory, then a big hello. Do get in touch with questions and comments about this or any of our other episodes. Or if you have a backstory to tell, then we'd love to hear from you. We are at The Backstory Pod on Twitter and The Backstory Podcast on Facebook and Instagram. To support us, you can leave a review on Apple Podcasts, like and share our stuff on social media, and get a friend to subscribe. It really helps. Join us on Tuesday the 20th of March to hear Martin and Mo's backstory. And don't forget to join us this Friday for Backchat. See you then. Thanks again to our sponsor, James, from 16 Degrees Coaching. Don't let your backstory define your future. Email him, james@16degreescoaching.co.uk.